Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, our wildlife ecologist. Before we get into that, I want to say a big thanks to Judith for her wonderful work on the show while I was away. It was great, always great to know that when you go away, you have somebody who was not only capable, does a better job than you most of the time. So I'm really delighted to say thanks to her. And I also want to say thanks to the 30 Wisconsin Public Radio listeners who joined me on our tour of England, London, and then County Kent. It was just an absolutely fantastic experience for me. I really enjoyed visiting. We visited, I think, right around 15 gardens off the top of my head, and saw some wonderful castles and other buildings. But I think the best part in many ways was just the people we got to meet. And I'm always pleased with Wisconsin Public Radio listeners, but I had a chance to get to know some people over 9 days, and that just only furthered my belief that Wisconsin Public Radio listeners are the best. They're really good people. And thanks to all of you. I bet few are listening. I hope you are anyway. Thanks so much. I hope we have a chance to do it again. And please, if you weren't one of the 30 who went on the trip, I hope you'll go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We have a whole photo album of our trip along with some explanations of each and every stop. And we saw some fantastic gardens. A whole lot different than what we have here in Wisconsin. In many parts of Wisconsin, we have a drought situation. And Scott, by the way, Scott, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
It's cool in here. That's a good thing.
That's a good thing. Well, while we were in England, people were emailing and saying, oh, you're wearing a light jacket, you're wearing a raincoat, it looks great, we're in 100-degree weather back here. And how's that affected our wildlife?
Well, it's in some cases there's been minimal effects, but in others I think the effects are probably pretty dramatic. Some of our wetlands are just plain disappearing, if not gone already. I talked to someone who works up at the Audubon Sanctuary Goose Pond up in Arlington yesterday, and it's gone. It's dried up. And out in the middle where the last water remained in a little puddle, that's now a thick layer of dried fish, minnows, absolutely dried, desiccated completely. Dunn's Marsh on Seminole Highway, which I pass coming into town right on the edge of the Arboretum, which is a pretty good-sized wetland. There's probably not but a couple days' worth of water left in a puddle in the center of that. So the troublesome thing will be the fish, the amphibians, and the turtles. Dunn's Marsh had a tremendous turtle population, and at least they're capable of heading over land and maybe finding some additional water. Or hopefully they nested before things dried up, and those eggs are now sequestered somewhere in a reasonably safe place. And if there's enough moisture and warmth late in the season to bring out those young turtles, there's a repopulation effect there. But for a lot of amphibians and some of the reptiles like turtles, it's at best a setback, and at worst a real problem, depending on how many of these wetlands disappear. So there'll be not much left but our river systems and the Sugar River and the Yahara River and so forth, and the lake systems around the southern part of it. I mean, it's not just a Madison and Dane County problem. That's just what I see. Maybe the listeners can call in and describe some of the bodies of water around their homes and what they're seeing happen. So it's going to be a problem. The other issue is there's virtually no water supply for birds. Around my backyard, we have no natural water. My water garden's under repair, so that's empty. I fill the bird bath, but it's dried up in a matter of hours. So yeah. I'm putting out some pans of water, and the birds respond. If I'm watering plants, the robins are kind of all gathered around me, hoping to dart in and get some moisture. But people need to be a little bit careful. Don't put out containers that are too deep. I put out one of these little child's wading pools so the dogs could cool off. And before I could literally before I could get around the house to put a log in it so that if anything got in it, they could get out, there were a couple of finches in it that had already drowned.
Oh.
And that's, I mean, that's unfortunate. So you're trying to help, and in fact, yeah. it's counterproductive. So if you do provide water, think it through a little bit so that anything that gets into the container, whatever it is, has a way to get in and out safely. So water, just for purposes of maintaining body temperature, is an issue. Water's an issue from the standpoint of the amphibians and turtles and such. And, of course, although things, you know, it's still middle of July, but as we look ahead to fall and think about, you know, the duck population, excuse me, continentally is still in pretty good shape. Pardon me. But you'd look at a duck hunting outlook, where the heck are they going to be?
Where are they going to be?
They're going to be concentrated on the streams and rivers, the Wisconsin River system and so forth, which may concentrate them and make for some better hunting opportunity, maybe. But a lot of the traditional places, if we don't get water soon, it's going to take a while for those to come back. So it's a big problem, completely different in the Northwoods.
Kathy in Hubertus has something relating to it. Let's go there. Kathy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott. I do have a drought-related concern for wildlife, but also, by extension, for humans.
Mm-hmm.
We have a pond. It's about 40 feet by 160 feet that we swim in. We also have an incredible number of deer around where we live. And this year, because the creek back in the woods, about 200 feet away, totally dried up, it's bone dry, the deer have been coming to our pond. And what they do is they just hang around about knee-deep in it. They're drinking. They're just standing there. Actually, the first time I saw one, I thought it was stuck in the muck. It was there for so long, and I was envisioning, okay, how am I going to tie a rope to it and drag it out? But next time I looked, it was gone. So anyway, we're getting a lot of deer just standing around, and every day, for example, I see two does, and they come with their three fawns, and they're standing in there all the time, which is fine, and I'm glad they're able to do that, and they're probably cooling off. But my concern, bringing it back to humans, is sort of worry about Giardia, just seeing so many deer in our pond. And we're going to have a family reunion here with a bunch of little kids, like six kids under the age of seven, who normally are playing and splashing in the pond and, you know, jumping off the floating diving thing. And
so you're worried about it. What do you think, Scott? Are there ways to test for Giardia?
Excuse me. If there are, Larry, I don't know what they are, but I suspect there are people perhaps knowledgeable about this who could call in and tell us. I think that at this point, it sounds like that pond has some depth to it if they've got a swim raft and the kids are diving around and all. So it sounds like there's enough volume in there to maybe take care of things. So I guess if it were my situation, I'm not sure how concerned I'd be about that unless the situation persists or the pond really starts to get low and diminish that volume. Water temperatures are very high as well. And, I mean, even Lake Mendota, which is a huge volume of water right now, looks like the color of your shirt, which the listeners can't see, but it's kind of a lime green. I guess this is a question that I'd recommend that she call, you know, maybe a local medical doctor, health clinic. Mm-hmm.
It's a tough one.
Or some municipal facility that deals with water quality and pose the question that way. It's not a concern I've heard before, and I suspect, although I understand why there's a concern, my gut feeling is it's probably not a big deal yet. It might be later on in the summer, but it is something that they should check out with somebody who knows about water quality.
Yeah, good luck, Kathy. Thanks a lot for calling. Relating to that, I saw a map this morning comparing, it's a colored map of Lake Michigan, comparing it yesterday, Lake Michigan water temperatures to a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very dramatic. The Lake Michigan temperatures are way up, in the 70s, in areas where it would never get to the 70s until late August.
Well, I would think that would have I think the fishery, for example, has been an early season as far as the trout and salmon and whatnot. If it gets too warm, I don't know where those fish are going to go.
Yeah.
Into the depths, I guess, and that may negatively affect the fishing.
Yeah, it certainly could. We have Gloria in Waukesha has a question for you. Hi, Gloria. Thank you for calling.
Hi. The front of my house is cedar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Rough cedar. And we lost a knot in the rough cedar about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we have birds living between the cedar and the inside of the house.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do with them after the birds leave? How do I get all that stuff out of there? Do I have to put something in to kill the whatever the birds left behind?
Well, I thought you were headed down the road that the cedar had been affected by woodpeckers and that they were making new openings. Actually, the situation you have is only a modest problem and is easily solved. I think once the birds are done with the nesting season and you're fairly certain they're out of there, or once there's no young, roust them out of there. And then I think if you can you reach it with a stepladder or ladder?
Yes.
Okay, then I if it were me, I would just go up there and with a coat hanger with a hook bent in it or something like that, pull out as much of the nesting material as you can, then give it a good shot of a spray insecticide of some kind in case there were any parasites in the nest, take care of that. And then I'd get a can of either Great Stuff or some of the other expandable polystyrene insulation products, put that nozzle in there and fill her up. Mm-hmm. And then go ahead and repair the knot hole. And that should be the end of the problem for past, present, and future.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. And Judy and Custer, hello to you.
Oh, hi, Larry. Welcome back. And hi, Scott.
Hello.
So I've got a problem with, or I have a question about, the relationship between chipmunks and other rodents and foxes and coyotes. And the reason I'm calling is that my husband and I both have Lyme disease, and I'm on the tail end of it. But I heard the strangest DNR report saying that one of the reasons central Wisconsin has so much Lyme disease is that the coyotes chase out the foxes, and the foxes usually keep those rodents that are a vector for it, keep them under control. So what do? I can go out there and kill chipmunks, which I'm trying to do anyway. I don't know how to kill coyotes.
Well, I really think that Judy, is a lost cause anyway. The notion that for any reason, whether for predator control to protect nesting birds or predator control to reduce problems with livestock or whatnot, the successes are marginal. And for someone who's trying to do it on their own without a concerted or large-scale effort, it's not very easy to see success. Now, if one particular coyote or group of coyotes were bothering livestock or whatnot, that could be addressed. But the general notion of using the food chain to manage the chipmunk population or the ground squirrel population or the myriad of other rodents that are out there to diminish the threat from Lyme disease is probably not a good strategy. That I think you're better off at the other end to deal with, you know, checking carefully for ticks, watching out for symptoms, and you're obviously familiar with it since you're both involved with it or getting over it, and just manage the disease rather than the animal population. Now, having said that, if you're concerned about the immediate right around your home, with the judicious use of either small live traps or rat traps baited with peanut butter, you can certainly thin the chipmunks and any other small field rodents living right around the home. You can thin them out pretty quickly, and you can keep the population down by maintaining that trap line, so to speak. But whether or not that it will measurably affect the risk of exposure to Lyme disease in your case, I just think that's kind of a long shot.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. This is the sixth time I've had it. So.
Oh, man. Well, good luck, Judy.
Good luck.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. That's a tough break. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist with UW Extension, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest today. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Scott, we've had questions already about deer and the new report has just been released from our dear czar, Dr. Kroll.
James
right.
Kroll.
And you've had it. You've read the entire 136-page report. I've read the executive summary. I didn't get my hands on the whole report, but maybe you can kind of lay out the main points or the key points to it.
Well, the report came out yesterday. It's posted on the Department of Administration website. And I would urge folks who are interested in deer, and there are a lot of folks in Wisconsin interested in deer, to have a look. And I think you can certainly see all the recommendations and the justification for doing this in the executive summary, which is only 7 or 8 pages. But in order to put the recommendations into context and understand why, for example, he was criticizing some of the numerical population estimates or why he said what he did about managing chronic wasting disease, I think you need to read the justification and analysis that they have in the body of the report, which is about 100 pages plus 20 or 30 pages of tables and graphs. The response is starting to come out today. There's an article in State Journal this morning that cited a couple of people on both sides of the fence. I talked to a couple of my DNR colleagues, and there doesn't seem to be any hair pulling or hand wringing or jumping up and down. And frankly, I think that's because the report was not all that inflammatory. I think people were worried that it was going to be a blistering indictment of virtually everything, and it wasn't. The concerns that Kroll stated that they were addressing were public concerns that they collected information on over the past 6 or 8 months, including too many predators, the DNR doesn't listen, the population estimates are inaccurate, what the heck are you going to do about baiting and feeding, and then finally get rid of Ernebuck. Well, the final one, Ernebuck, was removed from the table by the legislature last year, so that was off the table. And they focused on those, and then the actual recommendations deal with population estimates, with working with the public, with the chronic wasting disease program, a few other things. And I thought it was a reasonably well-balanced report. Now, I understand that there'll be some concern over a fairly lengthy initial assessment of these population estimates, the so-called SAK model, and the reliance on them, the heavy reliance on them in terms of setting population goals and subsequent regulations for the deer hunt. I'm going to have to leave some of the things that he said to the mathematicians and so forth amongst the agency and the university to sort out the validity of his points. But the bottom line is that the reliance on very specific numbers in fairly small areas, the size of our deer management units, has caused a fair bit of anxiety because you can make a calculation that in unit X, Y, or Z, there are 29.6 deer per square mile of deer range.
And yeah.
First of all, nobody has 29.6 deer per square mile exactly. Some have virtually none. Some have many times that. And this whole concept of deer range is kind of opaque to the public, too. So I understand why he went after that. But some of the suggestions in terms of still using that model but applying it to larger areas where the accuracy is presumably better, perhaps combining deer management units, combining a couple of regions like the two farmland zones, and using this primarily on a statewide basis seemed to make some sense. Likewise, there were a couple in the body of the report, what I thought were a couple of very well-developed sections, for example, the one on predator impacts. For somebody who's just uptight about, hey, what are the wolves and bears and coyotes doing to the deer herd, reading that section, I think, would perhaps make them feel a little better. The section on public relations or human dimensions, he calls and makes a number of requests in the report for better teamwork amongst the DNR, the landowners, and the hunters.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, there was room to think, for example, if you were involved in deer managers, oh, wow, we're really being taken to task here. But in fact, he went out of his way in 3 or 4 different occasions in the report to praise the professionalism, the dedication, the skill, and the cooperation that he got from all the agency people he worked with. He was pretty pleased with that. And I think if there was a conclusion to be drawn, and if, in fact, you agree that there are some problems, that those problems have come about by years of circumstance and perhaps intervention and give or take and so forth, and are not the work of any individual or any conspiracy or anything like that. Now, having said all that, the hunters were not without some blame here, and he had a very interesting kind of an add-on at the end of the report called an admonition, where he essentially addresses the hunters of the state and said, hey, come on, folks, you can't have a deer behind every tree. That's not good for the environment. It's not good for forestry. It's just not good. You can't measure the success of deer management on how many deer you see, because the harvest continues to be extraordinary.
Yeah.
So everybody kind of shares in both the blame, if there is blame here, and in the solution. Now, for my part, I was a little disappointed in a couple of things. For example, one of the issues, these issues I mentioned earlier, a decision on baiting. Well, his recommendation is make a decision on baiting. Well, come on. What's your recommendation? Should we get, I mean, there were a couple of issues, like the baiting issue and the use of crossbows, where he could have given that a little push.
Yeah.
By saying, I think he implied that, hey, use of crossbows is not the end of the world like some of our groups would suggest. It's not the end of the world. Other places have made the transition. You could at least go to 55 if not using it entirely during the archery season, or give them a special season. But he didn't really say that. He just said, resolve the crossbow issue and make a decision on baiting. Instead of saying, look, this is... You know, the pendulum has swung, I think, at least slightly toward finally getting rid of baiting and all the problems it causes. But he didn't push that. So there was really no progress on those two issues, and there could have been. The chronic wasting disease issue, he pretty much, the first general recommendation was, we need to take a more passive approach to this. Try and keep it from spreading. Watch for spread. Big response in things like this Shell Lake, you know, individual deer. But in the CWD zone, people are beaten down. People say the fun's gone out of deer hunting. Reassess whether or not some of these extra seasons are really contributing anything or not. And he made a couple of points where he said we need, people want to have the fun put back into the deer season and not have so many regulations changes on an annual basis and so much uncertainty and so much anxiety. And I can't disagree with that.
No.
I would like to have the fun put back into... You know, our hunt in the CWD area. And he could have been even a little more strong on some things like that. He analyzed, for example, the early October doe season and said, well, it really doesn't harvest many deer. And, you know, people are concerned that it upsets deer behavior and et cetera, et cetera. So his recommendation then, instead of, hey,
get rid of it.
And go back to your traditional opening day, he said, oh, you should reassess the utility of the early October season. So in some ways, it was watered down to the point where I don't see where anybody can be too anxious about what was done here. What will happen now with this big report, I have no idea, and it's going to take a while to digest it all. But I thought there were some good points in it.
Ann in Madison has a question or comment for you, Scott, so I want to go there. Ann, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, it is not a comment, it's a question.
Okay.
I will be vacationing in northern Wisconsin in a couple weeks. And we've seen bears in the area. And I am wondering if I go out hiking and use a shrill whistle, when I see one, if I see one, what would its response be? Would it actually scare it away, or would it draw the bear to the whistle?
Well, one of the things that people find interesting about wildlife is you don't know what the heck they're going to do in any given situation. So I can't give you a direct answer to that, except I can tell you that your chances of just randomly going up to northern Wisconsin and seeing a bear while you're hiking is pretty darn slim, especially with the jungle-like conditions up there right now. I mean, they've had plenty of rain. The woods are really thick, and there's plenty of vegetation. So the bears are going to know you're coming, and they're going to get the heck out of the way, 999 times out of 1,000. This is just a pretty slim risk. But if you want to carry bells, whistles the way people might do in grizzly bear country in the West, that's fine. If you want to carry pepper spray, that's fine if it makes you feel better. But from a probability standpoint, most people traveling in the North Woods would just be all Google-eyed about the if they saw a bear. So, wow, that's really cool. And it doesn't happen very often. But I understand your concern. So there are some websites. So the DNR has some good information on how to act and respond in bear country, and a nice poster to that effect. And there's a website and some information called Be Bear Aware, and some other publications that I think if you get on the internet and Google black bears, you'll find some useful information that should make you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll just tell you that the risk inherent in driving to northern Wisconsin is infinitely more hazardous than encountering
seeing
a black bear.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. We have a Facebook question from Mimi, who needs some advice on humane removal of a colony of bats from a home in Cross Plains. When will the babies be independent? When is it safe to assume that resident bats will leave the house at night? Any way to relocate a colony of bats? These are little brown bats.
Yeah. Well, okay. There have been quite a few questions like this the last few days. But the reality is, and based on this question, I guess the word hasn't gotten out very well. The rule of thumb used to be no bat-proofing, which is the solution to the problem, in June and July because of the presence of nursery colonies and young, helpless bats. Based on the regulations package that went into effect this past winter, because of the threat of bat impacts by white syndrome,
yeah.
Which, by the way, we should discuss the discovery of that in Iowa, not very far from
Wisconsin.
We
did talk about it the other day.
So because of that threat, a new regulations packet dealing with bats went into effect, and one of those is that no bat-proofing can occur. In other words, you simply can't deal with a bat colony between June 1st and August 15th by regulation. So it's gone beyond just being a humane issue, and it has become a regulation.
So
the bottom line on this particular problem is your bat-proofing has to wait until after August 15th, which is a reasonable average anyway. So at that point, once the young bats can fly and the adults are still going out regularly to feed in the evening, then bat-proofing using excluders and netting and all the other trappings that go along with the proper technique, which is well beyond what we can talk about on the air right now, then that can proceed. Hmm. And it should be done by the time first frost hits. That may be January, the way this year is going.
Yeah.
But at that point, then the bats become inactive or move to hibernacula, and that proofing comes to an end.
Farah sent us a Facebook question. She has a killdeer so close to their house. There's one right in her backyard, right at the back door. It keeps coming back when their three-year-old son tries to chase it away. Never seen them so close. We live on a farm. They're always around. Also live in southwest Wisconsin and could the drought be depleting their food supply?
Well, it's probably less of a drought issue than just either an inexperienced nester or one. The likelihood is that there was probably a nest in the open gravel dirt area somewhere around the farmstead. They nest in the wide open dirt or soil. And they're very protective parents and very conspicuous because of their appearance and their call and they're out in the open. So my guess is that although they may not have found it or seen it, there was probably a nest somewhere there in the barnyard, so to speak, and this behavior will come to an end here when the young are either fledged or if something's befallen the nest. So I guess interesting thing to watch. They're pretty birds and their kind of behaviors are neat, but I guess I wouldn't be too concerned about it, other than to maybe watch for the young or the nest and try and avoid causing them any harm. Although that should be over with by now.
Somebody was wondering what a killdeer looks. It's a bird, obviously, but what does it look like?
It's a long-legged shorebird type bird with two distinct black bands around their throat. Otherwise, they're kind of brown and white. They have a pretty wing pattern when they fly and a very sharp, high-pitched call. Very conspicuous
cool
once
call.
You see one. Yep,
I like the call. John in the North Woods wonders if there's a chance that the winter fishing regulations would change from 3 lines to 5 or 6. He says it's been 3 for years and years, and he's really hoping for a change that he could get
more tip-ups out.
More tip-ups out there.
Well, I guess, John, the best strategy is to take some more people with you so you can have lots of tip-ups out. But I've not heard any discussion about, in fact, I wouldn't be terribly surprised if it was going to change. I think it might
went the other way.
It might go the wrong way, John. So I wouldn't rock the boat on this one. I've just heard no discussion of going to more lines. And I mean, frankly, if the pike are biting, 3 tip-ups is about all I can run to. So,
Cheryl says she's wondering about spraying for gypsy moths. What do they spray for control, and does it have any effect on crops or animals? I live on a small hobby farm, and they've been spraying the area since early this morning.
This is a question
for Scott,
Phil,
or
for the DATCAP or DNR people who are managing the spraying. They're not putting anybody in jeopardy with this. The risk from the gypsy moths, and when things are compounded by drought and so forth, all these negative things are kind of piling up. I don't think there's any real... I'm surprised, actually, if they're spraying in an area. I thought they publicized the spraying and put out the... any safety precautions that were necessary. So I would just check into that with the people doing the spraying.
John in Green Bay, we turn to you now. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks a lot. Just a comment and experience my wife and I recently had, and it kind of piggybacks on the bear question that was a little earlier. We spent a lot of time up in northern Wisconsin, Clam Lake, Shawamigan, and we very rarely see bears. We did hunt them a few years, but... And you just don't see them. You see them, they're passing, crossing the road. But just recently, 2 weeks ago, we were coming back to Florence County down Highway 139, and then we hit Highway 8 between Dunbar and Goodman. And it was about an hour and a half before dark, and there was a large bear, maybe 350 pounds, on the side of the road in the ditch. We saw it. We stopped, and we sat and watched that bear from probably 40 yards away. And he looked at us a number of times, not a care in the world, and just was tearing up dirt clumps, must have been looking for grubs or something like that. But I've never seen that in Wisconsin in 30 years of going up into the Northwood. I've never seen a bear act like, you know, it was almost like when you see the lines of cars up in Alaska and there's moose sitting there and you're all watching this moose. It was the strangest thing, and it wasn't, it was a big bear. I just never, I don't know if you have any explanation for that. I don't know if he was so acclimated to humans, but we've driven that a number of times. I've never seen it. So, I don't know, just your thoughts on that. We left before the bear did. We sat there for 10 minutes and got lots of photos, and it was really a cool opportunity.
Well, I agree with your last statement. I think it was a cool opportunity, and you were able to take advantage of it. I'd like to see the same thing. But in terms of explaining the bear's behavior, that's a little trickier. You speculated, I suppose, if there were any housing around there, it could have been a fed bear that was... a bit habituated to people, although that's not a good thing. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that said bear had just found himself a really good spot, either with a lot of grubs or a lot of early black raspberries or something that he was really interested in, and he wasn't going to give that up just because a guy and his wife were sitting there taking pictures of him. And I think that's probably the most plausible explanation.
Okay. Marion in Roxbury. Hi.
Hi, I am wondering why squirrels are up in trees and cut little branches, little tip ends of big branches, and drop them on the ground, and that's it. And they seem to do it any time of year.
Well, the usual, I mean, sometimes they might cut twigs for purposes of nesting material if they're not finding enough otherwise, but ordinarily... it's something like an elm tree or something else that has fairly spindly, fragile branches but has seeds. Some type of seed or a berry crop on the twigs, and the squirrels have found that the winning harvesting strategy is not to do a tightrope walk out to the end of this flimsy little twig and end up taking a 60-foot dive, but rather to just go up there and frantically nip all these twigs off until the ground's covered with them, and then come down and harvest whatever it is they're interested in. And in most cases, when I've seen this, and it was a couple of big elms on campus, and I mean the ground would be just covered with twigs, and they were after the seeds that were out on the tips of those twigs.
Okay, it doesn't seem to be that in my case. They're maple trees, which have lost their seeds a long time ago, and honey locust, which do not bear any seeds in this case. And it's been real recent that it's happening.
Well, I still think it's somehow related to them collecting food. Now, both of those trees that you mentioned, the maple and the honey locust, are prone to squirrels chewing off the bark to get at the cambium or the inner bark or sugar layer of the tree as a food source. So I would be concerned if these trees are around your home. I'd keep an eye on it. If that's what's starting the squirrels, watch out that they don't start stripping the bark off the tree on bigger branches, as I've seen pictures of maples and in some cases honey locust, where the tree is basically, I mean, even big trees, naked. The bark is gone, except for the really heavy, coarse bark on the main trunk, and that's going to kill the tree. So keep your eyes open. That may be what they're after, but usually what gets it started is the seed cutting.
Yep, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Marion. Katie in Clinton, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a small creek in our backyard, Turtle Creek, and the kids go down and swim and play in it all year round. This year, it's very low. And about a week ago, the kids came back in running because they fished. And they had seen a few hundred of these little fingerlings come floating down. They're all dead. What we surmised was the heat might have been a little bit too much and killed off all the little ones, and now they're floating down. But the creek itself now has got all this algae growing up from the bottom. It's become a pea soup color.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting a little concerned about the bigger fish that are in it. My son came in last night. He says, "Mom, the turtles are having a feast. They're catching everything that comes floating, and they're actually able to see all these big snappers picking up these fish and eating them now." We're getting a little concerned about the health of our creek.
Well, you should be. I think that what you surmised is correct. That what are these fingerlings? Do you know what kind of fish they are?
The kids, when they've gone fishing, they've been able to get smallmouth, largemouth. There's been a perch or two in there, walleye.
Wow.
I mean, they're all, they come in with all different kinds.
In any event, I would have expected more of a mix of what I was shopping for was a cold water fish species like brook trout or something. But either way, things are getting so warm, as Larry mentioned earlier, even Lake Michigan is heated up, and that's a heck of a big body of cold water, that it's most likely heat stress that's killing them off, or if not heat stress, the heat stress is stressing them out, and then there's something else with the algae bloom or whatever else that you're seeing that's actually doing them in. But the problem is, much like the Madison Lakes, where they're issuing warnings about blue-green algae and don't let your dog swim and be careful in the water and all, there's not a great deal you can do about it except keep your fingers crossed like everybody else is. And if you know a good rain dance, do it in the yard tonight, because we need some cooler, wetter weather, or a lot of things are going to be suffering.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest Scott Craven talking the world of wildlife. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can also post a question on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. And you can post a question from there. Click like while you're there, and we'll send you regular updates. So lots of good things come to that Facebook page. And lots of good people calling in, among them Sue in Baraboo. Let's go there. Hi, Sue.
Hi, and my phone just started making this noise, so I'll try and call again.
Oh, okay. Yep. It's we weren't hearing it very well, so... call back, and we'll try and get you on when the...
So I was looking for Sue's question from Baraboo.
Well, please do call back, though, Sue. Wolves, I want to get to wolves because we haven't talked about them yet. And there's a here we've got a wolf hunt coming up. Apparently.
The big day, I think, is next Tuesday. I think it's the 17th in Stevens Point when the Natural Resources Board meets and finalizes this. But the rules package to essentially administer the hunt has been put in place. A quota of 201 wolves to be harvested has been set. Permits will be issued as $10 application fee for the permits. If you draw a permit, it's going to be $100 for the hunt. It's scheduled to run from the 15th of October to the end of February. A variety of techniques will be used. Quota is going to be split with Wisconsin's Chippewa tribes. So we're not talking about a lot of animals here, and we're talking about a learning process in terms of if a hunt is going to go forward in the future, there'll be a lot of lessons learned from this initial hunt. In terms of, we have no idea what success rates are going to be, you know, whether these wolves are not going to be easy to hunt. I'm not sure.
The length of the season and the fact that it's on during a time when the females are going to be with the young.
There are lots of questions like that that remain to be answered. There's still concern that this was, you know, very fast on the heels of them finally being delisted, removed from the endangered species list. But in reality, with the current estimate, now, you know, everybody wants to know how many wolves there are, and the current numbers being put out are between 815 and 880. But it's important, and many people have pointed out, that this is not a population estimate. It's a minimum count, essentially. And, of course, that's where the debate starts is, okay, so, yeah, you got at least 850, but how many more than that? Is it hundreds, thousands? Who knows? But there's a lot of concern over that number in the North Woods, much like the concerns over deer numbers we were talking about earlier. So it is a long hunt. The number of wolves taken, probably not a dramatic decline in the wolf population since, again, we don't really know what it is for sure. And in reality, when we've talked about it before, I think that some hunting pressure, maybe not this much, maybe not this structure, I don't know. That's for other people to decide. But some hunting pressure will, I hope, diminish the animosity toward wolves in the North Woods because people are now empowered to do something about the problems they feel they have. And number two, this should put some hunting pressure should put some respect on the part of the wolves for their relationship with people, which up to now has been, hey, people are no big problem. And these are animals that shouldn't be roaming around people's yards or snagging pets. And I'm hoping that a hunting season, if some good comes of this, it'll be those two things. And if they get the population of wolves back down to what closer to what the population goal was, I think everybody will be better off, including the wolves. Not certainly the individuals that are harvested, but the wolf population overall, is what the managers have to be concerned with.
On to Sue. Sue's back from Baraboo. Hi, Sue.
Hey, you can hear me now.
Yes.
Perfectly.
Okay, speaking of snagging pets, I have a recent experience that I'd like to share with you, and then I'd like your opinion. Last fall, I was out at Devil's Lake, and I like to go, like, on the Ice Age Trail and by Stanky Basin, and I'd been walking way back by myself with my Scottish Terrier puppy that was about 6 months old at that time. Well, and if you're familiar with Devil's Lake, I was coming back on that service road right by DL, and I was almost back, and right in front of me on the road were three coyotes, and then there was a fourth one off in the distance, and they were not far away. So I was coming upon a bridge, so I, you know, I thought, well, I'll make noise, and I got a stick, and I went up to the bridge and banged on the bridge, and then they just sat down and laid down and watched me. And then they finally got up, and this is a period of time. We're talking minutes, you know, not just a few seconds. So then they got up and they went on the other side of the bridge. They went underneath on the other side of the bridge. Well, I didn't know what to do. What should I have done? And then I'll tell you what I did.
well,
Probably what you did, because you're alive.
You're alive, and apparently your dog survived as well. So your course of action was perhaps one of several winning strategies. But, you know, I guess I don't know the setting, but if I were up on a bridge and they were sort of, you said they went under the bridge, so did they literally pass under you?
They passed under me, but then they went up, then they climbed up, and it's just a little, by bridge, you wouldn't think like a bridge with water or anything. It was just a little
like a footbridge.
Yeah, like a little footbridge. Very little. Very little. Why I felt safer on that, I don't know. I mean, what could I have done? It's just that there was a little tiny bit of a railing. But like I said, they were blocking my way to the parking lot. And I'm talking, I'm not good at feet, but I mean, very close.
Okay.
Very close. And then they went to the other side. Well, I didn't want to go to the parking lot. I mean, and they were blocking the way. I didn't want to go deeper into the woods. So what I did was call 911. And if you're out at Devil's Lake, there's, like, no reception. So this was in itself quite a feat because I had to keep calling back. And, you know, I'm sitting here holding my dog, and they're not moving. You know, I was just very surprised because I'm a farm, and I'm, you know, and I've gone out there for years, and I'm not afraid, but it gave me pause to think. Well, anyway, so 911 then did contact the ranger, who came barreling up the road, and that's when they went away. And the ranger said that was unusual. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so it was a little bit, you know, early for them to be out at night. But anyway.
Well, I guess I hadn't thought of the 911 option. And even if I'd had my cell phone in my pocket, I probably wouldn't have thought of it then either, because I probably would have been whatever I was banging on the bridge with, if I could back off and had gotten a hold of a stick or a stone or whatever, between whatever commotion and a well-placed stick or stone, I think that they would have fled the scene. With that kind of an approach, and then I'd have quickly gone on my way. But it is unusual for them to behave that tamely. But, again, it's one of the problems around the state where coyotes in areas where there's high public use become habituated to people, and there's not a great deal of pressure on them. And the dog may have been a little added incentive to hang around.
He was on a leash, but, he was small and black, and that's what people have told me. I did go online, and they said to do what I did, not call 911, but, you know, to get a stick and bang and shout, and, you know, and that's what I did. But they also, it also said online, to make yourself look very large. I'm not very tall.
Yeah, there's only so many things you can do to look larger than you are. So, I mean, things worked out, but people do need to be aware of, when they encounter animals like that, that although the risk is probably low, there is some finite risk, and you need to be, you just don't ignore them and go about your business. You need to address it the way you did, and things worked out for you.
Yeah,
right.
Thanks, Sue.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. All right, Doug in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call, gentlemen. Great show. Find it very interesting.
Thank you.
I've got just the last week or so, a yellow finch who knocks incessantly on the front door, which faces east, and also on a north side window, and it's driving my cat nuts. And wondering, what's up with that?
Well, that's called cat disturbance behavior. They hate cats, and it's seriously, I've got the same problem on the sliding door to our deck, not with a goldfinch, in this case with a male cowbird that we've named Jack. And he was there again this morning. I thought he was gone, but my wife's not going to be happy to hear that he was back. But he just goes right from the railing, kind of flies in and scrambles a little bit on the glass, drops down to the bottom, defecates a few times, which is beginning to pile up, and scratches at the door. And this is a matter of the far more common problem in the spring: robins, cardinals, a few other species that see their reflection in the glass and then go after their reflection.
Yep.
And of course the reflection never goes anywhere, so it's an endless do loop in a computer term.
Yeah, we've lived here 15 years and we've never had
this
problem before.
It's the first time I've heard it with a male goldfinch, and it's the first time I'd seen it with the cowbird, too. But I think if you want to end the behavior, just take a piece of opaque paper or some bird netting or something else that you can tape or using Velcro tabs affixed to the door in question, and the bird will no longer see its reflection and will likely find something else to do with its time.
Sounds good. I appreciate the tip.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for calling. And Charles in Appleton, quick question from you. Hi.
I was wondering if it's legal for farmers to use a trout stream. This is a beautiful trout stream called the Lear, to siphon the water out of that and irrigate their fields. This is a little river. It's beautiful. It has natural brook trout in it.
Well, this is another spin-off from the drought conditions, because once the governor declared a state of emergency, literally, I think it was earlier in this week or the end of last week, that paved the way for farmers to pump water from lakes and streams for irrigation or for their stock. So my guess is, because depending on where you are, I think there were 41
Appleton.
Counties in the declaration. And my guess is that what the farmer's doing is probably legal under the emergency rules brought about by the declaration of emergency. But you can certainly check on that with your local DNR office. And, you know, I can't imagine they're drawing enough water to. We're out of time. We'll come back to this. But just be sure that there's not irreparable harm to the trout stream, if at all possible.
Scott Craven, our guest, with us till 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're taking a look at the wonderful world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist. Tell you what, he does a wonderful job every time he's with us, and he usually comes by the first Wednesday of every month, and here he is back again. We've been talking about deer, we've been talking about wolves, we've been talking about drought, the two D's and the W, and gotten onto a whole bunch of other topics as well with him, including maybe yours. If you want to join in, I hope you will. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and post a question, photo, or comment there. Click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates. We'll be back right after the news. With habitats that range from wetlands to prairies to forests to savannas, no wonder that here in Wisconsin we enjoy a rich diversity of wildlife. And I think it's really part of our culture to notice and appreciate what's going on around us in different seasons. And really fortunate to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven with us. Comes by once a month to share what he's been seeing and kind of to help us understand what's going on out there. And Scott, great to have you back. And I know one of the things you and I have done over the years has been to participate and sometimes be master of ceremonies for a variety of banquets. That raise money for wildlife, and I know there's some coming up.
Well, there's some coming up, and there throughout the year there are numerous banquets in, say, the Dane County area, but there are chapters for many of these organizations all over the state. So people often ask what they can do personally to help wildlife a bit, and these various conservation groups that sponsor fundraising banquets. And there are a slew of them. Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, the
Turkeys.
Ruffed Grouse Society, Wild Turkeys, the Prairie Chicken Group, Dane County Conservation League, Rocky Mountain Elk, Whitetails Unlimited. There are scads of them. And the banquets are all fairly similar. They involve a good meal and some social time and lots of raffles and prizes. But the primary purpose of those banquets is to raise money that these groups then put back into conservation. Either habitat protection or purchase or programs for youth, all sorts of stuff that needs to be done but wouldn't be done if they didn't have the money. So bottom line is, you know, if you see something advertised and you're looking for something to do on a Thursday night or whatever, think about going to one of these fundraising banquets. You might.
They're really, a lot of fun.
They can be a lot of fun. I still emcee a couple, the Conservation League and Pheasants Forever, and they're fun to be involved with the people who are running them, and the people have a good time. And as I say, a lot of money is generated for conservation. Now, the next one I know of that's coming up is Thursday, the 16th of August, basically a month away. And that's the John Keener chapter of the Rough Grouse Society, their annual sportsman's banquet. It's at Candlewood Suites out in Fitchburg. Cocktails and raffles at 5:30, dinner at 7:30, and so on. The format's all pretty similar.
Yep.
But you know, pick your species that you're interested in helping out, and in this particular case, it's rough grouse and woodcock and really good forest stewardship. I'm particularly sensitive to this group because they, of course, got us started with our coverts project that we talk about on the air. And, you know, we've had 500 and some landowners go through that program now, and I think we've, through extension and that workshop, we've been able to do a lot of good for a lot of habitat. And that goes back to the Rough Grouse Society being willing to foot the bill for this in the early years, and there are many other sponsors now. But anyway, that's the Rough Grouse Society banquet on the 16th of August. And if somebody's interested in attending that, I think the thing to do here is contact the chairman. I'm guessing if you could Google the chapter off the Rough Grouse Society and get the information. But the fellow who's running the banquet is Jim Schurz, and it's just J.F. Schurz, S-H-U-R-T-S, at mailbag.com, and you can get tickets and go and help them raise some money. This just happens to be the one I'm familiar with, as I say, Pheasants Forever and Ducks Unlimited, and it goes on, and they all basically are well-intentioned, and the money goes to good use. So help them out a little bit.
I once won a complete turkey hunting outfit, including the shotgun, calls, clothing, the whole works.
You are one lucky guy.
I was lucky there. I surely was. Ann in Madison has a question. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I wondered I think that wolves are capable of mauling dogs, but I wondered whether they ever turned on human beings. And in that regard, in Wisconsin, I believe children as young as 8 or 10 can go hunting with their families. Are they going to be allowed on these wolf hunts?
So was the question, will wolves maul dogs initially? I think that was the comment.
No.
That's one of the difficulties in the North Woods in particular that has led to the interest in the wolf hunt, and that's that significant numbers of hunting dogs and pets have been killed by wolves. It's not a matter of roughing them up a little bit. It's a matter of killing and consuming them, among other things. So that is a big problem in the North Woods. And in terms of the wolf hunt, I have not seen anything that would suggest that there would be different age restrictions or parameters for the people who go along. Now, you have to have a permit, and it's an expensive permit, so I'm not sure that a 10-year-old would likely draw or get or even want a permit, and I don't think there's any provision for a special youth component to the wolf hunt.
Oh.
Maybe down the road sometime, but I don't see any restrictions that I've heard about that would suggest that little Johnny or Susie, who's 10 or 11 or 12, couldn't accompany dad or grandpa or mom or whatever if they have a valid permit and are going wolf hunting.
Hmm. Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. And Kent in Pulaski, hello.
Yeah, hi. How are you guys doing? My concern is like what the lady was talking about, was using dogs for wolf hunting. I mean, it's not like a bear. They're going to climb a tree. They're going to tear these dogs up. And it's and we have reports of that from in Taylor County where they got beagles and stuff where the people were snowshoe hunting. That was just a concern I wanted to
bring up.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, it does seem intuitively a little problematic to hunt wolves with an animal that wolves don't get along with, and that part of the impetus for the hunt came from wolves killing dogs. But this is strictly a case, any houndsman who's going to use hounds or any other kind of a dog to hunt wolves has to be aware of the risk to their animals, and they either take it or they don't. This is not, that's not something, amongst all the things in the wolf issue that I might lose a few winks of sleep over, that isn't going to be one of them.
And I wonder if the I'm thinking of the timing on the season. It goes through the traditional nine-day deer hunt, doesn't mm-hmm. it? So could be people actually just by accident, sort of like when we used to have bear permits.
Well, yeah, except that there'll be so relatively few permits that the likelihood your deer camp, for example, with 14 or 15 guys, if one person had a permit, it would probably be a surprise or an anomaly, and, you know, what are the odds?
Yeah.
If it were wide open and say, hey, anybody in the woods during the deer season can shoot a wolf if they see it, that would be a very different situation, but that's not the case.
Tom in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello, gentlemen. My question was about the cougars. I know there's currently no breeding populations of cougars in Wisconsin that we know of so far, but I may have encountered one here about 4 years ago on the river between Prescott and Diamond Bluff. I like to hike along the river right at the base of the bluff, and one afternoon I kept hearing this low growling noise up above me on the bluff, and it seemed to be following me, and I shook it off for a while, and it just kept on, and I finally, you know, a hair stood up on the back of my neck, and I decided to come down off the bluff and start hiking the river, and I'm just wondering if I might be smart in the future to take along a friend that can't run as fast as me, or maybe take a neighbor's dog with me for bait, or how apt is a cougar to want to jump off that bluff on me?
Well, not very. There are parts of the country where cougar-human problems have occurred. Vancouver Island, California,
are areas where that
happens. There have been others elsewhere, but given the fact that we've only had over the last few years, and it was only 3 or 4 years ago that the first animal was actually documented, the Milton cougar that was ultimately shot in Chicago, there have only been four, I think, that I can think of in the last few years that through trail cameras and blood samples and so forth have been documented, and they seem to be moving animals. The likelihood of encounter is still very, very low, and the likelihood of risk from the encounter is even lower. So, you know, among the things, Tom, that you worry about on a day-to-day basis, being jumped on by a cougar is probably not something to be too concerned about. What was actually growling or moving around? There are lots of other possibilities besides cougar. I think it's just kind of human nature to want, when you think you've seen something or heard something, we all sort of want it to be the coolest or rarest thing it could have been, and there may have been an easier explanation. If you kind of want the background on all this, in the June 18th State Journal, and I assume online you can go back through issues of the State Journal, there was a big spread called Cougar Population on the Rise in the Midwest, and it went through the issue of questions about how people can and will coexist with this reemerging predator. The dateline was from St. Louis, but it applied to the entire Midwest and kind of summarized the situation. So if you wanted to go back and find that, I think it would answer most of your questions.
There you go. Thanks, Tom. Warren in Baraboo. Hello.
I have a problem with moles. Too many of them.
Mm-hmm. You want to get rid of moles in your lawn?
Well, mainly in my wife's flower garden, in my vegetable garden.
Yeah.
And you're probably watering.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's why moles are down deep, 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 deep right now, except in circumstances where people are irrigating. And the moles are just as desperate for loose, moist soil where they can find worms and other invertebrates to feed on as any other animal right now. So it's really the watering that's keeping them a problem and may actually be concentrating them more than they would be if we were receiving normal rainfall and the moles were distributed. So in any event, that may be the explanation, but it doesn't tell you how to deal with the problem. So you have a couple possibilities. Are you seeing the pushed-up ridges and so forth in the gardens?
In the gardens, actually, they've undermined so much of it that I don't have nice tunnels that I could use a harpoon trap.
Okay, you don't. If you can use the harpoon trap, that's the first line of defense. If you can't, but you can find some of the tunnels, the tactic that people talked about quite a bit on the program last year was to excavate some of the tunnel, carefully excavate it so that the tunnel itself isn't destroyed but opened up, and then just place in the opening a plain old rat trap baited with bacon, mm-hmm. and then cover the whole thing with a wash tub or an old quilt or a tarp or a big old basket to keep it dark. And people were claiming very good success using that technique. The other options, if you want to try it, is part of your irrigation. Mix in with a hose end sprinkler one of the still relatively new mole repellents like Mole Med or Shotgun. There are a couple of them the garden centers will carry that are based on castor oil. And by watering that in, I can't tell you for sure whether the moles will decide, wow, I'm not going out in that drought-infested open ground, even if there is castor oil here. I don't know what their thought process is going to be, but that's another possibility. And then the final one is the still relatively new gummy worms. The trade name on at least one of the more common ones is Talparid, and these are gummy worms that look like a worm. They taste like a worm, apparently, and they're infused with a toxicant that will kill the moles when they feed on it. And these you actually place into the tunnels or runways that you have access to. So,
all right, so
you have a few options to try.
Can I ask a question about the bacon? Is that raw or is that cooked?
You know, Larry, do you remember? I remember asking somebody about that, and I thought that they kind of singed it a little bit.
I asked you partially cook it just so that that brings the scent.
Right. It needs to be, I think it really needs to be pliable enough that you can closely affix it to the trigger, say with a twist tie or something. And if you made it crispy, it's just going to fracture. So I think middle ground is what you're striving for.
Okay, great.
Use most of it for a good BLT and put the other slice on the, on the mole trap.
Okay, have a great day.
Yeah, thanks. You too. Thanks a lot for calling. Elena in Madison. Hello.
Hi, Larry. Hi. Thank you for the opportunity to ask your guest a question.
Sure.
And I do appreciate your show, and I'm a regular listener. My question has a little bit of a story to it. I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with Hitchcock's movie The Birds.
Yeah.
And this could be another film opportunity for that might be called The Loons. My nephew was swimming on our small lake in Vilas County near Eagle River, and he noticed one of two loons that reside on the lake duck under the water, and a minute or two later he felt a sharp object pierce his foot, and it was like glass cutting his foot, and he realized it was bleeding. He realized that the loon had attacked him with its beak. And so in our experience swimming up there, we've never had a problem like this. So I just wanted to present this to your guest and ask if this behavior could have been because the loons had an egg on their nest that apparently they abandoned, or they were upset about that, or are they upset about climate change? And Jonathan, my nephew, is the nearest human, and they could take it out on.
Well, animals do lots of strange things. I've never heard of a loon attack on people, and I'm inclined to believe that the explanation was either, somewhere not too far away may have been a nesting attempt or whatnot, and they were being defensive. But I'm more inclined to think that the swimming activity had probably stirred up either a toe looked like a fish or something else, especially if the water was at all murky from either the swimming or just, you know, cloudy water. But also, as I was swimming last week up in Lake Tomahawk, the pair of loons with their young were surfaced 20 feet away. It was fantastic to see them that close. And as we were swimming, there were huge schools of minnows attracted to our activity. And they were actually, it was kind of like these deals where you put your feet in a minnow bath and they chew off the exfoliate. There were minnows nibbling on us and they were just thick. And I could imagine a circumstance where the loons are, whoa, there's a big school of minnows. And in the process of snagging a minnow or a toe or whatever, you know, the contact was there. But that is really bizarre behavior, and I don't think we can attach any malicious intent to it, that it was either some attraction to fish that were stirred up, or a mistaken identity in the case of the toe, or just a bad break.
Good story he'll have the rest of his life.
It's certainly a good story, and I will tell my loon biologist colleague up in Rhinelander, Mike, about this and see if he has any light to shed on it. He works with loons on a daily basis, and maybe we'll have something to report we can put on the Facebook page.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot. That'd be cool. If you find something out, we'll post it. Get her up there. Mary in Watertown. Hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
You were talking about those wonderful fundraisers for different organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My mom has a bunch of geese that she would love to donate. I don't know that the geese would be too keen about it. They're coming up the Rock River into her yard,
mm-hmm.
and they have stripped her garden. They've even eaten the leaves off the jalapeno plants.
Mm-hmm.
So my mom has fenced in the garden. They can't get to that. So they've moved on to the sweet potato vines and have stripped those and anything else they can get in their greedy little beaks. So instead, she can't fence the whole yard off, and in lieu of donating a bunch of geese for a fundraising event, what can she do to keep them off? Because they're not scared of anything.
Well, so these are Canada geese that are simply living along the river.
Wild geese,
I mean, goose problems are rampant throughout this countryside, but this is yet another impact, I think, from the drought that as I watch some of the ponds around where geese have nested, they're out there with the now almost full-grown goslings scrounging around in grass that's the color of an oak board, and there's just nothing green for them to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that where people have a lush garden or anything they're watering, as in the case of the mole collar a moment ago, that's unusually attractive for the geese. Under normal circumstances with normal forage, attacking a garden like that would be extreme even for these semi-wild geese. But the if the property backs up to the river, the place to think about the fencing is right along the avenue of approach, to try and prevent them from getting into the yard or deflect them to the neighbors where, hey, what the heck? I mean, we'll see what happens over there, and go after them that way. And it doesn't have to be a particularly elaborate fence. They don't even like a piece of heavy monofilament fishing line strung at about breast height that they will deflect them. And I think that's probably the winning strategy.
I had that same thing at our lake home. Actually, it was my neighbor's problem, because at our lawn right along the shoreline we had plants that were a barrier, and the neighbor had no plants and just grass right up to the sand and the shore. And we came home one day to find probably 40 geese on his lawn. Can you imagine?
Yes.
40 geese.
Well, it's a mess, and a mess and damaging the plants, but I think attempting to divert them from even getting out of the water and up into the yard is probably the weakest point where you can attack them.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. She'll have to pick which neighbor she likes.
At least.
That's for sure. But the monofilament line, if you, but I'm telling you, plants, normally, you can have a nice barrier along the shore, and also probably protect from erosion and everything else. So there's a lot of potentially good things for that. And Mike in Greg in Luxembourg? That was Mike. Greg in Luxembourg, there was a documented cougar sighting on July 2nd east of Green Bay in the rural New Franklin area, shown in a farmer's field. Did you see anything about that, Scott?
I did not see that one. And I, you know, I guess I, the ones that I've had a lot of faith in are the ones that have multiple sightings or some validation. There are still lots of photographs, for example, circulating on the internet, and when you finally track them down, it may or may not be where someone said it was, but it's certainly possible. I mean, they get around and they can cover a lot of ground in a short period of time.
And finally, Wayne in Krakow wonders, he has an acre pond with a healthy population of fish, bluegills, bullheads, minnows, fatheads, 13 feet deep, and only moderately weedy, is there a temperature point at which you should start becoming concerned and maybe getting an aerator or a pump of some sort in there?
I think that's where you call the local fish manager for the DNR and say, look, here's my farm pond situation. And if not the DNR, then the folks at FSA, at Farm Services, in the NRCS, who help with pond construction, they can help. There probably is a temperature point. Not going to be able to do much about the temperature. The oxygen level may or may not help if the temperature gets to a critical point.
So yeah, it may or may not.
There you have it.
Scott, always a pleasure. We'll see you next month, huh?
We'll see you next month.
All right, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. Great to have him along. And certainly thank you so much for listening in today. Just to let you know, tomorrow at 11, Chad Spade and John Viner are here to talk about green and energy-efficient home improvement. And so we're looking forward to that. And once again, thanks to all those folks who went with me on our trip to England. It was a lot of fun. More next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.